Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Michael Pappas, Executive Director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council, and I'll be the chair for today's program called Democracy in the Muslim World. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my distinct pleasure, honor, and privilege to introduce to you Bonnie Joy Caslin, the Honorary Consul General for the Republic of Turkey in the San Francisco Bay Area, who will offer some brief remarks.
Good afternoon and welcome again. Thank you very much, Celia. And some of you may know that I have, for the past 30 years, had the privilege as well as the challenge of representing the people of and culture of Turkey to the people and culture of the United States. That being said, for 30 years, I've seen tremendous changes, and we're in the middle of more changes. In 2002, the present government, the AKP party, Mr. Erdogan, came to power, and some contend that that has forever changed the political landscape of Turkey. Turkey is about to face elections 2014 and 2015, and it can be said that as then, in 2002, there was tremendous influence, participation by the followers of the cleric Fethullah Gulen. The alliance has sometimes unraveled, and we now face, and I think have this tremendous opportunity to have as a speaker today Professor Alp Aslandwan, who I believe is Professor at Montclair in New Jersey, my home state, to ask to pretend you're back in the classroom and to put aside the facile images, the newspaper headlines, but as if you were in a classroom, to think and analyze critically. And you have this incredible opportunity today to ask the hard questions, because Turkey is an important ally. Turkey is a strategic partner of the United States. And as such, Turkey also needs to be recognized for the role it plays not only in the region and the world. So those of us who are interested in that relationship need to be educated at a depth, regardless of what our passions may be, so that what we do as citizen diplomats has a positive impact on the relationship between the two countries and the people. And to that end, we do have our, Michael will be introducing and giving the background, but we have a unique opportunity. And so to the Commonwealth Club, I say thank you for allowing people to go beyond headlines, to go beyond media images, and ask the hard questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorary Consul General Caslin, for your comments. And now it's my distinct pleasure to introduce our speaker. Dr. Alp Aslandwan is the president of the Alliance for Shared Values, and he will focus on how the Turkish experience can be a guide to emerging democracies in the Middle East. He will also discuss how to prevent extremism and violence in the region. Dr. Aslandwan is inspired by the work of Fethullah Gulen, as you mentioned, a controversial Muslim scholar whose followers promote interfaith cooperation and improving communities through service. And rather than saying more, because I think the speaker is probably well-versed in this, would you please join me in giving a warm San Francisco welcome to Dr. Alp Aslandwan.
Thank you, Michael and Celia, for the introduction, for arranging this. Well, I come from New Jersey, and I am a secret fan of the West Coast, especially this area. Some years ago, when I was a graduate student in Cleveland, I believe, many years ago, I heard on the radio somebody from San Francisco talk about San Francisco, saying that I love this place so much that I am a person, when he goes to heaven, he's going to say, it ain't bad, but it ain't San Francisco. You know, as a Muslim, of course, it's inappropriate for me to say anything like that, but I thought that's such a beautiful way of expressing one's affection for his place. And I think anybody who visits here really lives with something in their heart for this place. More recently, I also learned a lot from people in this area, from a professor in University of San Francisco, I believe, that sugar was bad, and another professor about the intersection of the language and the thoughts. But here we are discussing the topic of democracy in the Middle East, and I think you will agree that it looks as elusive as ever. It's a difficult process. It's a painful process. It doesn't happen easily or fast. There's no silver bullet. The Turkish experience definitely provides not just one example, many examples for the region, for democracy. But we should remember that examples can be examples to replicate or to take as a model, or examples to avoid. And the Turkish example has both. And I'll try to touch upon them. But first, given the political environment in Turkey, I think I should address first what's going on now and the role of this movement in the current developments in Turkey. We have a ruling party who is in power for the third term. And recently, in December, a corruption investigation began. Technically speaking, five of them began, four in the city of Istanbul, one in the city of Izmir. And these corruption investigations involve some serious charges. Legally speaking, I think they are not at the level of charges yet, but they will become charges when the case is submitted. They involve millions of dollars found in shoeboxes in the home of a director of a bank, additional millions of dollars found on bookshelves of the same director, six big steel electronic vaults found in the home of a minister's son, $300,000 worth watch on the wrist of a minister, and a phone conversation about getting it from a businessman. Video and photo surveillance, phone surveillance of an Iranian businessman visiting a minister's office with a big suitcase. So there is definitely a serious corruption investigation going on. The government's response to this investigation was massive. The police chief of the city of Istanbul was removed and replaced with a bureaucrat with no relevant experience in running a city department, a police department. The prosecutor in charge of the first three investigations, was initially pacified with two additional prosecutors assigned to the case, and then he was subject of a media smear campaign, and then he was removed from the case. The other two prosecutors were also removed from the case, replaced with another one. Initially, hundreds, now thousands of police officers, investigators were removed, replaced with others. Some of them were removed from their places three times in a few weeks. Some prosecutors received threats from parliamentarians and advisors to the ruling party. Sentences like, if you pursue this case, your end will be like this other prosecutor who end up dead in his house. So government reaction was very massive and was not very positive. Corruption investigations, of course, happen everywhere. It happens in UK, it happens in US, it happens in every country. When there are humans and there is money, there is corruption. But this form of government reaction, I think, was unprecedented, even in Turkish history. Now, the social movement, the civil society movement, which I'm a participant of, which was originated by the Turkish scholar and preacher, Mr. Fethullah Gulen, it was charged as being behind this corruption investigation because allegedly there are sympathizers of Mr. Gulen in the judiciary. Now, it is very natural and expected that there are sympathizers in Turkish judiciary and other institutions, just as there are people of various orientations and political views and ideologies in Turkish government institutions. For instance, in Turkey for many decades, the Kemalist ideology was the official state ideology. Technically, it still is. And the adherents of this ideology are still heavily represented in every government institution. Other segments of Turkish society are also represented. So to blame a corruption investigation on a civil society group is a little bit odd, but actually it makes perfect political sense, and hopefully I'll explain that later. But let me give you an idea about this movement. How did it start? Because it explains why it is now the subject of these allegations of a power struggle. It began in the 60s, late 60s and early 70s of Turkey, when the country was facing very serious problems. One was economic dysfunction and corruption, poverty. Another one was street anarchy. People with different ideological views, political views, were literally killing each other. My mother remembers one day when we were in the park and when she called me with my kind of nickname, which is Alparslan. It's a combination of my middle name and part of my last name, right? But it's more importantly, it's the name of an old Turkic commander, and it is a symbolic name for Turkish nationalists. So when my mother called me in the park with this name, a few faces turned to her very angrily. She felt like if she were not a woman, she would be beaten, just because they named me with that name. So we had that kind of environment in the 70s. In addition to that, on the streets, the youth literally killed each other with guns. Thousands of youth died. So the country faced economic dysfunction and poverty, anarchy on the streets, and also in the government institutions, there was systemic, historic disenfranchisement or discrimination. Namely, any person who did not subscribe to the Kemalist ideology was seen as a threat to the regime. And there were different methods of identifying who did not subscribe to the Kemalist. Just for the record, Kemalist ideology is not developed by Mustafa Kemal, after his name, but actually people around him. And there are signs in history that he was not very happy with this ideology. He actually detested ideologies. He thought that ideologies are static, and he always wanted a dynamic worldview. So it is not attributable to him personally. But in any case, this was the official state ideology. And for people who did not subscribe to this ideology, they were automatically seen as a threat, regardless of their educational background, expertise, and etc. There were different symbols to identify those people. For instance, for observant Muslims, a silver ring would be a symbol because it's not a golden ring. That means this is an observant person, so he or she is a threat. Not a she, but a he would be a threat. Sometimes they would actually check underneath the knees to see signs of ritual prayer. For a nationalist, the certain kind of mustache would reveal them. For a leftist, there were other signs. So if you're not a true Kemalist, you would be a threat to the regime. So because of this discrimination, many parts of the Turkish society were not represented in government institutions, at least not at the high levels. They could be represented at clerical levels, and I should not even talk about the religious minorities. They had no chance at all. So Mr. Gulen's effort in those years was to invest in education as a response, as a positive response to these three problems. Namely, against street anarchy. What is the source of that? The source of it is to see every other worldview as a poison. It's either my way or the highway mentality. How do we solve that? We can only solve that by educating young minds to embrace others, to accept others as fellow human beings, even if they think differently. So through education, we can solve the problem of this monolithic, harsh mentality, authoritarian mentality in our youth, so we can save our future. Through education, we can give opportunities to the impoverished families, children, in government jobs, in business, private sector jobs. And also through education, we can produce, we can help these young generations get the qualifications to qualify for government positions. Therefore, they can apply and get positions in the government. Now, in the government, there was this discrimination ongoing, but also on the part of the bulk of Turkish population who are moderately observant Muslims, there was also a kind of a attitude toward government jobs, which was exacerbating the discrimination. Basically, the attitude of the observant Muslims was this. I'm not going to send my child to the military school because if they go there, they'll have to drink alcoholic drinks, they'll have to, you know, dance and, you know, all, do all sorts of things that are against my religious practice or faith. Therefore, I'm not going to send them to military school. Bureaucracy, very similar. I'm not going to send them to law school because Turkish law is based on Swiss law, Italian law, German law, many things against my faith, so that's out. Business school is out because it's based on interest and interest against the Islamic faith. So the attitude of the bulk of the population, about 60-70%, was to basically shun those institutions. Then combined with the government side discrimination, this produced a situation of non-representation of the bulk of Turkish society in their government's institutions. So Gülen's effort was to break this taboo, if you will. He told his audiences that you are the citizen of your country. This is your government. You have every right to be in this government, in the institutions of your government. Even if there are certain things against your faith, your current strategy, your current situation is no better. Because people who don't think like you occupy those positions, and they every day they keep life, make life harder for you. Therefore, send your children to those institutions, be represented, and try to live your faith within law, within the system. That was his message. And this was embraced increasingly through decades, and with the help of certain democratically elected prime ministers in Turkey, the discrimination was also broken. And in the current situation, in the Turkish government, we do have a representation of Turkish society. You can see all the colors and the textures of Turkish society in Turkish government. But this situation, of course, is bad in the eyes of the former kind of monolithic thinkers that who think only certain thinking is allowed in high-level Turkish positions, government positions. Because of this advocacy and the representation, now we are facing these charges of a political struggle or other charges because of this representation of the Anatolian population in Turkish government institutions. In addition to investing in education, the movement participants formed hundreds of foundations which focused on other areas which are related but not exactly the same. For instance, they focused on dialogue, both interfaith and intra-faith dialogue, for the purpose of bringing human beings together. When human beings don't come together, it's very easy to label people. Okay, I am a Muslim, you're a Christian or Jew or atheist. And I think of you as a label. I am a nationalist, you're a communist or you're a socialist, you're a label. But when we come together, we are two humans. And if you are familiar with Rumi's works, Rumi says that when two humans come together, it is two human souls who are looking at each other through the window of the eye. Just think about that next time you face somebody that you love or your friend. So this dialogue effort was focused on bringing members of different faiths in Turkey, the majority Muslims and the minority Christians, Jews, and other denominations. Also intra-faith, that is, people with different political, ideological views, bringing them together, because they would not come together or else they would fight each other. But Hizmet movement, as we prefer to call it, provided a platform called the Abant platform, which brought together over 100 intellectuals of all political, ideological orientations every year to talk about social issues which affect everybody. So we may not like each other or each other's views, but we are in the same boat. So let's fix the problems of this boat while we continue to disagree. If we learn to respect our differences, that's the only minimum requirement for this job to be done. So dialogue was very important. It still goes on today. There is an institution in the area, Pacifica Institute, which promotes that effort. There was also an effort in humanitarian assistance, healthcare. In Turkey, there are several hospitals. Outside of Turkey, there are several hospitals and medical centers that are run by doctors and nurses, sometimes voluntarily, sometimes at a minimum wage. and they bring help to disasters, victims of disasters. They bring help to very remote, difficult to reach places such as Darfur region of Sudan or Somalia. They have, for instance, finished digging over 1,000 wells in Somalia for the Somali victims of the situation there. Name every big disaster recently, and they were there helping the victims regardless of their faith. Their annual budget, there's one relief organization, their annual budget is about $100 million raised from Muslims for everybody. Another effort was professional associations, including business associations. So there is, for instance, a doctors' association in all major cities, which have thousands of members. So these members volunteer to go to places like Somalia and Sudan. There are engineers' associations. I once met with a lady who was an architect. She said, "I have done the drawings for the buildings in a village in Darfur." Pro bono, without charge. That's my contribution. So this is an observant Muslim lady, architect, doing pro bono architectural drawings for a village. I thought that was a beautiful story. There are also business associations, and the purpose of the business associations is, first of all, to function as business associations, help each other do business, and also help generate their donations to charitable causes. So these are basically the areas of activity for the movement participants. So let me now come back to the democracy in the Middle East and what can we learn from the Turkish example and what deserves or what examples, what experiences appear to be worthy of repeating and what experiences are they should not be repeated. Right. Let me start with the lessons first. The essence of democracy is absence of domination by a majority or minority. This is one of the foundational definitions of democracy. But it doesn't happen only with laws and institutions and systems. It is a matter of culture, a democratic culture. So it is a chicken and egg problem. Where to start? Without democracy, how do you nurture and promote democratic culture? Without democratic culture, how do you achieve true democracy, non-domination? Somebody has to start. So here, I guess, we have to adopt Mother Teresa's strategy. Instead of cursing the darkness, we have to light a candle. So within our means, establishing democratic culture is our contribution. And there's a story that I like that gives me motivation every time in such matters. So in the Muslim tradition of Abraham, a Muslim story of Abraham, which is a little different from the Christian Judaic story. Abraham is put to fire, and he is about to be consumed by fire, and there's a little bird that brings some water to and puts on the fire. And Abraham tells the bird, you realize that this is not going to make much of a difference, you know, this big fire. The bird says, I know that, but I want to, the world to know that I'm on your side. So at least we can be on the side of democratic culture, nurturing a democratic culture. So the chicken and egg problem, democratic culture and democratic society, maybe can be solved through that. International institutions, democratic institutions, have a role to play. In the Turkish example, they did. Interestingly, the combination of the Soviet Union threat and the NATO membership was the impetus for Turkey to open up for the first free elections. So the first free elections in Turkey were held with the help of a Soviet threat, which pushed Turkey toward NATO side. And the NATO countries, especially the Scandinavian countries, said, well, Turkey is neither Atlantic, right, and NATO, nor democratic. So why should we accept Turkey? So the government accepted the first free elections. And the first free elections were won by the Democrat Party. And that was the, you know, the opening of the democratic era for Turkey. Before that, it was a single-party era. So both citizens, civil society organizations, and democratic international institutions can play a role. European Union played a big role in moving Turkey toward a more democratic society within the last decade and a half. Starting in the 90s, late 80s, Özal's time, European Union requirements for membership, they were implemented step by step. And it was the biggest external impetus for helping defeat the military dominance in Turkish politics. For decades, the Turkish military staged coups and otherwise pressured the elected, democratically elected government in the name of protecting secularism. Well, the irony was that out of the three or five, four prime ministers removed, only one was an observant Muslim. All the others were not observant Muslims at all. The first one who was removed from power with a military coup in 1960 and later hanged, he did not even pray in his lifetime. He was no, radical Islamist or anything like that. He was just a Democrat. The second prime minister removed from power, he was not an observant Muslim either. At one time, the second prime minister called on Turkish girls who are covering to go to Saudi Arabia to get their education. And he was removed from power. It was not in the name of secularism. This is a big, misinformation that I see in places. But the European Union was instrumental in tipping the balance in favor of pushing the military back to their mandated, constitutionally mandated role of defending the country and not mingling in the domestic affairs of the country. And it took four military coups and many people were lost, assassinated, disappeared, tortured before Turkey was able to finish this domination. The real enemy of democracy, the second lesson, the real enemy of democracy and the freedoms is not necessarily a particular group or person or a political party. It is a mindset. It is the authoritarian mindset. And we don't need to look any further than what's going on right now in Turkey. The civil society movement that we call Hizmet or Camia, inspired by Gulen, have supported the current ruling party for the three elections, because their promise was, first, end economic dysfunction and corruption. Second, support Turkey's effort to become an EU member. Third, end the military domination in politics, basically the authoritarian mentality. Now, how ironic is that in their third term, they appear to be adopting that very same mindset they promised to end. So, the enemy of democracy and freedom is a mindset. It is not a person, a party, or a group. Unless, of course, a group adopts an authoritarian philosophy as their basic principle. That's a different story. Militarism in domestic politics is always a bad idea. They typically lead to more corruption, more oppression. They are not brought up with a democratic culture, with a democratic mindset. Certain times, their intervention might appear to be positive, but in the longer term, they don't serve the greater good. Long-term corruption leads to authoritarianism. They are like twin sisters. Long-term corruption cannot be sustained in a democratic society. It has to bring about authoritarianism. So that explains the magic of the two terms for U.S. presidents. There is something there. Some people have learned lessons in history. For checks and balances on the government or for any authority, the diversity in the society, in the institutions, is the key. I grew up reading Cumhuriyet newspaper in Turkey, which is a very Kemalist or maybe a left Kemalist, left version of Kemalist paper. And when I was reading it when I was a young kid, high school, middle school kid, I thought there was no other paper worth reading. Then I realized, at least at that time, the paper actually embraced a very authoritarian mentality, authoritarian interpretation of Kemalism. Now, after years, I find myself and this civil society group on the same side of the debate in this debate. How ironic is it? So diversity is good, even if it means there are people who don't like you, whom you don't like, and whose views you don't like. Democracy is much more than free and fair elections. And the freedom, freeness, and fairness of the elections should always be carefully observed and maintained. Democracy is much more than free and fair elections. and also the elections themselves, whether they are truly free and fair, should be monitored, should be ensured. Independence and the fairness of the judiciary is necessary for everybody. It's necessary for everybody. Unbiased observers and international democratic institutions can be catalyzers for positive change. These are the lessons, I think, the Turkish experience teaches us. So I'm going to conclude in a few minutes, Michael.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. Whether in Middle East or any other place, in South America, Africa, whether democracy will take hold and will be for the longer term, whether it will lead to a truly democratic society, depends on external and internal dynamics. The external dynamics means agreements, alliances, the influence areas of big powers. How they affect the current situation in that particular country or region is important, as we have seen in Turkish example. Internal dynamics, the role of the military, the role of the media, whether they have the more democratic mindset or not, whether they have, as far as the media is concerned, whether they are diverse or not, is very important. Political parties, their philosophies and worldviews, obviously, is very important. The role of the civil society, the relationship of civil society and the political actors is very important. I think the Turkish example shows that or you can also consider the Egyptian example for that matter, the strong coupling of civil society with political actors and the government is a bad thing. There is an inherent tension between civil society and being in power politically. I think it's also the beauty of the American democracy that American government truly gives the civil society the freedoms so they remain civil society and also support the causes that they like or they oppose the causes they don't like. The role of the bureaucracy and the judiciary are very important, but most importantly, it is the democratic culture. From the Turkish example, what are the good lessons we can learn and what are the bad lessons? Good lesson number one. A Muslim conservative party ruled for more than 10 years without breaching secularism. And we can criticize the ruling party for many things, but they did not breach secularism. They did not try to intervene in people's private lives. And I do have criticism for them for other reasons. But this is an example, this is a demonstration that it is possible for a Muslim conservative party to run a government for a longer term and not breach secularism. Of course, you know, the prime minister's rhetoric sometimes sounds like interference in people's lives, but it is just rhetoric. We have not seen any legislation passed. We have not seen government institutions enforcing people to adopt religious lifestyle. So I think this is a good lesson. Another good lesson, military no longer intervenes in domestic politics in Turkey. And this was achieved with an alliance of observant Muslims, religious minorities, Christians and Jews in Turkey, the Kurds, the liberals, a whole segment of the society. According to the 2010 constitutional amendment referendum, 58%. And if that referendum were not politicized, probably it would reach 70-75%. So this coalition ensured military does not come back to the domestic politics. Another good is the economy, by and large, improved significantly. These are the good lessons. The bad lessons, the experiences that should not be repeated, if the allegations are true, there is systemic corruption in the government. So this is not something that should be repeated. There are 5 corruption investigations, and the situation seems to be pretty serious. Individuals should be assumed not guilty until proven otherwise. Another bad lesson is economy is not on solid foundations. The deficit, both the account deficit and the other deficit are serious. It's a fragile economy. Although development has been in place for over a decade now, it appears that the foundations of the economy is not that solid. Another bad example or lesson is the ruling party has increasingly become authoritarian during their third term. So there is a magic to 2 terms. Authoritarianism in the form of subjugation of the media, government officials basically telling media editors to shut off certain party leaders' speeches and things like that, or firing journalists. authoritarianism in the form of subjugation of the judiciary, threatening prosecutors, shuffling prosecutors, elimination of separation of power, and authoritarianism in the form of profiling and purging citizens, spying on citizens, profiling citizens. So the very foundations of democracy, according to some observers, are being eroded right now. These are the bad examples that should not be repeated. And coming back to the original question, could Turkey serve as an example for the democracy or the emerging democracies in the Middle East? Yes, but in two ways.
Thank you very much, Dr. Aslan Doğan. Let's have a round of applause for your comments. And now it's time for our question and answer period. I'm Michael Pappas, Executive Director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council, and your moderator for today. And we have a large number of questions here, so let's begin. I did want to say, in the spirit of full disclosure, I was born and raised outside of Montclair, New Jersey, so we want to put you at ease. But the Honorary Consul General did give us permission to ask the tough question. So I'm going to accept the privilege of the chair and ask if what I'm about to say is a fair assessment of the Gulen movement's motivations, because that's one of the questions here. One of the questions is, what is Gulen's goal? In the United States, we have something called enlightened self-interest. And I have heard it said that one of the motivating factors of the movement, and I think you kind of talked about it a little bit, was both educational and financial, in that by protecting the rights of the minority populations in Turkey, that would allow easier entry into the EU. And secondly, by protecting the rights of the minority populations, that observant Muslim women would be able to enter into university. Is that a fair assessment, and or is that just short-sighted?
This movement grew out of two dimensions of development, if you want to call it that way. One is the personal spiritual development. The other one is the social reflection of this development. So the personal spiritual development pertains to, for Muslim participants, it pertains to a particular understanding of Islam. But it has a social reflection. In the social reflection of this spiritual development, the idea is that as you grow yourself spiritually, there should be a reflection of that in your society. That is, you should do something for others. Because true happiness, as is now being demonstrated scientifically, amazingly, true happiness and fulfillment only comes through helping others. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come through taking things for yourself. So in Gulen's words, this was expressed as the dedicated, devout participants of this movement are people who find their happiness in the happiness of others. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the social dimension and the social goals, we can say that the goal is to nurture a society, starting with the individuals, where everybody respects everybody else as a human being, and they are committed to their dignity. This means adopting standards such as EU standards, the democratic standards, the rule of law, respect for the rule of law. But more importantly, this inherent, deep, internalized respect for every human as a dignified creature of God or individual. Whatever you mentioned is part of this greater social vision, if you will, where people don't hit each other or see each other as a threat simply because of their worldviews or political views.
Thank you. Oftentimes, we're impacted by our neighbors. This question asks the question, how is the Syrian tragedy affecting Turkey?
It is affecting heavily. There are hundreds of thousands, I believe, refugees within Turkish borders. There is instability. The Syrian side is ruled by groups which are hard to describe, which present a clear and present danger to everything that we value. Frankly, without the intervention of international democratic bodies, I don't see how that can be resolved. but it's affecting Turkey very heavily. The relief organization within Hizmet Movement that I mentioned, Kimse Yokmu, actually is helping the Syrian refugees, and every day, you know, they serve many tens of thousands of refugees there. The cities in the area are flooded by refugees, in addition to the ones mm-hmm. who are in the camps. There are also people who move to the cities and live there, rent apartments and things like that. But it has it's a very serious impact on the society there. Yeah.
I know that journalism and journalists in particular are an important part of the Alliance movement and the Gulen movement. This person asked the question, please comment on the high number of journalists incarcerated in Turkey.
The problem of freedom of expression and freedom of press in Turkey has multiple dimensions. One dimension is what you're referring to is the incarceration of journalists. This is in part because of the legal system. Some of the laws that are in place are too harsh. It is very easy to incarcerate a journalist for their actions. It is also due to the mentality of certain prosecutors. You know, this authoritarian mentality is not unique to just one group. It has been nurtured and it has been taught in schools in some subtle ways to everybody. Everybody is influenced by that. So the respect for the freedom of the expression and the press that we observe in the Western world, unfortunately, it's not yet there in Turkey. So the combination of the harsh laws and the mindset of certain prosecutors results in this incarceration situation, and it's a real problem. But I think more important problem for freedom of expression and press is the media subjugation and control. Basically, there is a strategy of carrots and sticks on the part of the ruling party leadership. Certain media organizations are basically they are allies, and their owners benefit from this alliance being close to the government. Certain other media institutions are threatened. In Turkey, media owners can own other businesses, and they do. And for those other businesses, they rely on the government for permits, for bids, for inspections, for taxation, and everything. So the government basically holds them at their will and sometimes threatens them. And recently, if you're following the media, you have seen some public expressions of frustration by media owners and media editors.
Okay. We had two questions regarding the relationship with Israel. And so I'll combine the two, and I think you can address them. The first is, could you comment on the new rapprochement between Israel and Turkey? And the second is, has the need for the ruling party to become more inclusive impacted Turkish-Israeli relations?
The second part, could you repeat that?
Has the need for the ruling party to become more inclusive impacted Turkish-Israel relations?
Well, let me respond to the first one that sounded easier to me. From within the movement's perspective, mutually beneficial and warm relationships with all the neighbors and indirect neighbors mm-hmm. is something that we value. During the 2010 Flotilla incident, Mr. Gülen criticized the approach of the Flotilla organizers out of the principle that when there are other means of helping people in need, confrontation should not be the first choice. Mm-hmm. As expected, that situation led to terrible deterioration and resulted in the previous situation, which is now being mended, and we are happy to see that being mended. We just wish that a warm, mutually beneficial, principled relationship can be established with every neighbor and indirect neighbor.
This person wants to get a perspective of what life was like pre-Erdogan and asks the question, didn't Gulen help to remove the secular government before Erdogan? I don't think the secular government has been removed, but if you could address that.
This is an interesting topic of discussion, which probably deserves maybe one or two separate talks. Because the use of certain terms do not translate to the same concepts in different languages. Mm-hmm. So in Turkey, people talk about being laik or laiklik, which is translated as secularism. But the practice of laicite or laiklik in Turkey is nothing but secularism. So looking from that perspective, the Western style, Western liberal understanding of secularism. The observant Muslims of Turkey are happy to live in such a society. How do I know? All my friends who live in America are very happy as far as the religious freedom is concerned. So this form of secularism, where the government neither intervenes or helps a particular group in terms of religious practice, is the form of secularism Turkish Muslims actually yearn for. But in Turkish society, historically, secularism is interpreted in the French tradition, like the Jacobinist tradition. That is, it is essentially anti-clericalism, sometimes anti-religious sentiment. That is, religion is seen as a poison for progress. Therefore, from the beginning of the Republic, the government ran every single mosque and told imams and preachers what to preach. So every imam to this day is a government employee. Basic religious freedoms were removed. My grandmother, for instance, was a devout lady. She never learned how to read the Quran. And the reason was it was a crime to teach and learn Quran when she was a child. The people who were caught by the military police teaching or learning the Quran were beaten and put to jail. This is not secularism. On the one hand, oppression of religious practice. On the other hand, controlling religious practice through mosques and imams. This is not the only element of secularism that was in Turkish society or government was the laws are not based on Islamic laws. That's the only element. All the rest of the practice is nothing but secularism. Therefore, Western liberal understanding and practice of secularism, observant Muslims of Turkey are at peace with it. They look forward to it. And I think many Muslims in the region will also welcome such secularism.
Okay, now this question, I'm interested in the answer because our council is going to be hosting a group of Abrahamic traditions to talk about this issue. Are most Turks observant Muslims?
Majority of Muslims are moderately observant. That's a short answer. According to three or four polls that I have studied in the process of writing a book, which I am now rewriting because of the current developments, according to those three or four polls, about two-thirds of the males go to the Friday prayer, so which is roughly the equivalent of going to the Sunday service. A higher percentage of the people than that observe the fast in Ramadan. So 60 to 70% of the people actually fast in Ramadan. So I think that gives you an idea of the observance rate.
Okay.
There are groups who are not observant at all, and there are clearly a significant segment, I don't know, 10%, 15%. Not only they are not observant, mm-hmm. You know, they see religion as a poison. So we have all that diversity.
Okay. I've moderated a half a dozen of these, and this is the first time I've received emails in anticipation, which probably accounts for the fact that this sold out. One of the emails I received, and it's somewhat related to this, this person asked, who began the corruption investigation? I would ask you to add on to that the complex relationship between Erdogan and Gulen, and why, as of late, Erdogan seems to be distancing himself from Gulen, if that is the case.
And vice versa. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For the initial period of AKP, the ruling party, a broad spectrum of Turkish voters supported them. Because the campaign premise in the first election and the second election in Turkey of AKP was, first of all, we're going to move Turkey toward European Union membership. That means we're going to implement those democratizing reforms that are required by the European Union. And to give them credit, they have done that. They have actually taken those steps to democratize Turkey. They have promised free and fair economic policy, opening Turkish economy even further to the world. And they did that. Economic development was there. So the support of this movement, as well as other segments of Turkish society, was based on those democratic principles. And especially the promise to remove the military tutelage, the military domination of Turkish politics, the profiling, the labeling of citizens. These were the promises. And they also delivered on that. But after the third election, the magic election, the practice made a U-turn. Unprecedented powers were given, or there was an attempt to give these powers to the intelligence unit, the intelligence directorate, to spy on citizens and profile citizens. For instance, an agreement was published where the intelligence directorate made an agreement with the Turkish Airlines and the Ministry of Education to spy on citizens without any court order or anything like that. There was an effort, an attempt to give operational powers to the intelligence directorate. There were other measures. There was an attempt, which didn't go forward, to regulate student homes where students, you know, college students live together. There was an attempt, a rhetoric, to regulate those homes. You might have heard about it. The whole sector of prep courses, the college prep tutoring centers, now face abolishment. That means it's going to be a crime to run a math tutoring center if this law passes. So these the anti-democratic measures basically led to a big disappointment in the minds of people who supported this party for democratic reasons. So right after the constitutional referendum in 2010, this diversion, this rift began, and it has intensified since then.
Okay. I know that as part of the social fabric and the social change movement, that education is an important part of the Gulen movement. And as one who had the opportunity to go visit firsthand, one of the things that impressed me were the number of parochial schools, if you would say, throughout the land. This question asks, how many charter schools does the Gulen movement have in America?
The answer is zero.
Okay.
Because the movement is an abstraction. The movement doesn't have or own anything. Individuals, foundations run everything everywhere. Mm-hmm. Mr. Gulen certainly personally does not own anything. He doesn't own any real estate or any wealth. All his ownings are just a bunch of books. But starting in Turkey and increasingly abroad, all the institutions, all the projects that are done by individuals and the foundations that they establish. Now, education being a core area of activity, you know, investing in education being a core value for movement participants, wherever they go, be it Central Asia, be it the Balkans, North Africa, Southeast Asia, or Australia, wherever the participants go, they want to contribute to education in some way. In my example, for in my personal experience, when I was a graduate student, I was tutoring kids in a local community center. And then I became a part of a group to start a private school. Mm-hmm. I was also part of another consortium, which failed to get permission for a charter school. So individuals who are personally inspired by Mr. Gulen's teachings, they get involved in various forms of projects and institutions and activities. So this happens to be just one area. But it is by no means owned by any other party. It is owned by the local foundation, and technically they are all owned by state.
Okay. In the course of your talk, one of the cards that came up said, but he's not talking about democracy in the Muslim world, and then you switched to it, and you did talk about it. A question. Based on what's going on in Turkey, is Turkey a poor example for Arab Spring countries?
I think it's a mixed example. The short answer is it's a mixed example. There are experiences that should not be replicated, that we should learn not to repeat, and there are good experiences that that can be either replicated or taken as a model. Mm-hmm. For instance, as I said, the military dominating domestic politics is never a good idea. So that's a good example in Turkey, a good experience, where that role has now finished. Nobody fears a military coup anymore. Sometimes, you know, looking from outside, you know, people might see, well, we don't really necessarily like military getting intervened, but, and then, you know, some reasonings are given. Ultimately, a military is a military. I mean, their training, their mindset, it's a military. To expect democratic outcome from their intervention, I think, is short-sighted. So that's a good example. And another good example is, with the right mindset, it is possible for observant conservative Muslims to run a political party, to run the government, without interfering in people's lifestyles. I think that's also setting an example that may be a first.
Okay. I'm not sure how germane this is, but you could answer. Is the Muslim Brotherhood a threat to modern-day Turkey?
Muslim Brotherhood, I don't believe they have many sympathizers in Turkey. There are certainly some, but there is no group, a significant group that you can point out to as their kind of affiliate in Turkey. Mm-hmm. So the short answer is no. There are people who sympathize with them, but I don't believe they represent a significant part of the population. Maybe this is this can be seen in the example of the predecessor to AK Party, which is the it was multiple parties because they ended up getting closed one after the other. But their leader was Erbakan, and their idea was what is now called political Islamism, which I don't like, but that's how it is called. And that party, in most elections, never got more than 10% of the vote. In one election, they got over 20% of the votes because everybody was so frustrated with all the other parties, they said, let's give them a chance. So, you know, broadly speaking, the idea of political Islam or having a political role for Islam in the government, that idea has never got more than 10% support in Turkey.
You know, I got a vocabulary lesson today earlier because you used the word laiki, right?
Laiki, yeah.
And I'm Greek, and now I think I know where that comes from, the term secularism. I'm wondering if you could help shine a light on another word that I think I heard you mention, but I don't know if the audience picked up on. What is hizmet, and why is there a polarized view of hizmet in Turkey?
Yeah, hizmet is one of the names by which the participants refer to the movement. Literally, it means serving or service, means mm-hmm. community service. But the idea is doing something for others. It was one of the reasons why I was attracted to this movement when I was a college student. So when I went to this college, I saw some students of Mr. Gulen, and their idea was that, okay, our country is not in very good shape, but we can do something about it, and we should do something about it. And when we do something about it, even if it fails, what do we lose? Mm-hmm. I like that idea. They were hopeful. They were positive. And what do you lose if you are part of a positive change? What do you lose if your effort doesn't succeed? You have nothing to lose. So hizmet means service. And about the polarization, this has historic roots. In the first few decades of Turkey, this official state ideology was taught to everybody. And every other worldview was depicted as a threat to the regime. It doesn't matter what you do. Your actions don't matter. If you have a certain worldview, which is identified by symbols, you're automatically a threat to the regime. So the regime in those years used various mechanisms, including media, to depict every other group as a threat to the government. And he's met this tradition of civil cultural Islam happens to be one of the victims of that propaganda. It is not alone. Basically, pick any group of Turkey, any group in the society, there are polarized views about them. You know, Turkish left at one time before the 1980 elections, Turkish left was believed to be the greatest menace, and the military mm-hmm. coup was essentially, in their words, staged to prevent a communist revolution. So that was the great menace at the time. The Kurdish citizens who did not accept to identify themselves as Turk. In other words, they did not accept the Turkish identity. They were also depicted as a threat. Simply refusing to speak Turkish. For a while, the Kurdish language was banned. Their mother tongue was banned. And many of them, actually, after 1980 military coup, many of them got tortured and disappeared in the Diyarbakir city prison. Whereas in a democratic society, speaking a mother tongue is not necessarily a threat to the regime. So I think Hizmet movement is the victim of a kind of a monolithic mindset that paints every difference, every group that doesn't think like that as a threat. And periodically, there were smear campaigns in Turkish media. initially in the early decades driven by the government itself, mm-hmm. Later driven by the military when they played a dominant role in politics. So it is not because of what people do, because everybody who gets in touch with this movement, they get back impressed. And usually when they see this polarization, they are puzzled, because when they visit the institutions, when they meet the people, they don't see anything that should lead to polarization. This polarization is essentially, it's a matter of a monolithic worldview on the part of some people.
Unfortunately, we have time for only one last question. And this one last question, I'm going to try faithfully to synopsize what I see in four questions here. I think that perhaps there are some members of the audience here who would consider themselves secularists and would be frustrated with some of the things you've said tonight, today. If you could help us to understand why you think they would be frustrated with what you have to say, I think that would be helpful for the audience.
Well, as I mentioned, I grew up in a secular family. I grew up reading Cumhuriyet newspaper, which is a very secular Kemalist paper. And I understand the concerns and the fears of people who identify themselves as secularists. They genuinely fear the threat of a regime like Iran in Turkey. They genuinely fear by allowing the observant Muslims who represent the majority of the country to be the political power, that will ultimately lead to an Iran-like regime. So that's a legitimate fear. It's sincere and genuine. But there is no sociological basis for it. There are no sociological studies which demonstrate that Turkish people, by and large, support such a regime or such a mentality. It is mostly driven by sometimes propaganda, sometimes misinformation. And I don't know if there's any easy way to really resolve that that concern. But all I can say is that the people that I know are very happy to live in a society which gives them the religious freedom and which gives everybody else to live without religion if they so choose.
Well, thank you, and thanks to Dr. Alp Aslandawan, President of the Alliance for Shared Values, for his presentation called Democracy in the Muslim World. We also want to thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the radio recording and on the internet. I'm Michael Pappas, Executive Director of the San Francisco Interfaith Council. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.